said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. I mean, this one thing to do is pull. They made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
They ignored it because they wanted it to happen.
Every bloody one starts with a false flag operation.
True Mason is not creed-bound. He realizes with the divine illumination of his lodge that as a Mason, his religion must be universal. Christ, Buddha, or Muhammad, the name means little, for he recognizes only the light and not the bearer. There is no place for little minds in a great work. Manly P. Hall, mystic and Freemason. Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Historica Esoterica. I am, as always, Detective Roswell, joined by my good friend,
Matt Kaltra.
Matt, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I survived that attempted deep state assassination I mentioned earlier, where
yes,
they lit my washing machine on fire. But other than that, you know,
it comes right out of the handbook, just another classic case. So today we're talking about a concept which I thought would be pretty interesting and turned out to be sort of interesting, which is the concept of the Freemasons, which you probably, if you're listening to this, familiar with them vaguely. There's a lot of conspiracy theories that go about this organization. So I figure we can just jump right in and talk broadly about what it is, define what Freemasonry is.
What I found, I must just say up top, is that everything included in any Dan Brown novel is true, and we can just end the episode there.
Our work, it's done for us. So essentially what it is it's a fraternal organization, you know, a social club, but this one is often with religious or secular goals or overtones. And, you know, we think about the word fraternity that comes from the Latin word frater, which means brother. So it's a brotherhood, you know, which sounds a little creepier than a fraternity, but that is kind of essentially what you're dealing with. This is a brotherhood of people, usually men, until more recent times, almost always men, united under a shared kind of goal or a shared brotherhood. And the Western understanding of these types of fraternities developed in like a Christian context, as is the case with the Freemasons. So there's absolutely a religious element to Freemasonry, at least early on. And essentially how this group is organized is it's organized into these local lodges where the members can go and meet to have social events, conduct business, and perform rituals, interestingly, or attend lectures, all sorts of things. And the lodges are private, members only, and under the jurisdiction of like a more regional Grand Lodge, which I thought was interesting. That another word for Grand Lodge is the Grand Orient, which is weird, but I don't know why you'd call it that, but they do. And for example, the U.S. has 1 to 3 Grand Lodges per state, I've noticed. Like the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania being the oldest one.
It tends to vary from state to state, but that is generally about what it is.
That's about what it equated to by my bad math.
Yeah.
The oldest one being, like I said, the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania, which has the largest in membership, I should say. And it has, at the time of this recording, 111,661 members. So that's pretty big.
Not bad.
Is there anything you want to add about just our general definition of what Freemasonry is?
No, I think you've covered it thus far. As you start getting into some more specifics with the history, I'll probably sound off a little bit.
Yeah.
I think so far that's a good broad concept.
Yeah, it's essentially a fraternal organization, this kind of secretive, exclusive fraternal organization. mainly in Europe and the United States, although there are some exceptions, like in the Middle East.
And Argentina, as I will touch on later.
That's right. More on that in a minute. So basically, like, how did this start? And without getting too deep in the history, the origins of these Masonic lodges seem to begin with stonemason guilds from the Middle Ages. But it's sort of hard to pinpoint, like, an exact origin, because the earliest known sources are Masonic and tend to romanticize or, like, mythologize its origin. A good example of this is from the oldest extant source of Freemasonry, which is the Hallowell manuscript, that talks about how the craft of masonry originated in Egypt, but was brought into England in the 900s by King Athelstan. Another manuscript, the Matthew Cook manuscript, states that the craft can be traced back to Jabal, the son of the biblical Lamech in Genesis chapter 4. In the 1700s, the Crusaders were added to this mythological lineage by a French writer. And from here on, it sort of became an all bets are off deal, with Knights Templar being added to the lineage, Noah, and even Jesus Christ. So it was kind of a lot of like, yeah, those guys were, they were Masons too. They're part of our club, you know, but with no real evidence.
My favorite of that is, you know, the sources that claim that it goes back to the stone workers who built, like, the Temple of Solomon.
Yes.
It's like, oh, of course you're dragging Solomon into this. Let my boy rest. He's
he was bottling all sorts of spirits. Now he's tired.
Yes. He's working with Aleister Crowley. Like, he's a very busy man.
Yeah, he's in everybody's rights, it seems. Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was reading about some of the oldest, like, Masonic, like, garb that is still preserved, and they were named after Barak, and it was the two pillars of Solomon's temple.
Goodness.
You know what I'm talking
I'm blanking
about.
On it now too, but I know what you're talking about.
It's two other biblical names, you know, named after earlier stories in the Hebrew Bible, but that was also the name of these garments that are kind of the, I believe, one of the oldest physical, you know, remnants of Masonic gear. But yeah, so there's a lot of interesting stuff like that. Again, this is overtly religious. But going back to medieval times, what we do know is that these stonemasons of that time period were very liberally educated, were very highly thought of, and could make a lot of money. Especially a master mason could become quite rich. So this was, at this time, especially like in France, this was a pretty good, cushy job. As for the term Freemason, the origin kind of also hard to pinpoint, but the earliest official English documents about Freemasonry are written in Latin and French. The two that are written in Latin refer to it as the, and excuse me, Latin majors, Sculptores Lapidum Liberorum. That's from the London 1212. And then the thank you. And then the Magister Lathimus Liberum Petrarum from Oxford, 1391. And then the final one is in French, which is the Maître Mason de Franche-Pierre, which is from 1351. And the reason I mention all of these is because they all roughly translate out to a type of worker who would work with freestone, a specific type of stone, which was used for ornamental masonry. So not just your standard builder, but kind of an architectural subtext is what we're getting from this term. And the word free comes from the concept that these wouldn't be indentured servants or enslaved laborers, but these would actually be skilled workers. So this is a craft that is well thought of, and these were guilds to represent this craft, to be hired for by the Catholic Church or by other bodies to complete some sort of work. That's around the general kind of gist of how it started.
Yeah, that's the other thing about, like, this time period is it's all so vague because, like, three people could write. So, you know, there's not much in the way of detailed record keeping.
No.
So eventually,
what is kept as record is, again, kind of hard to trust because they're like, yeah, also Noah, Adam, they were also doing this. It's like, all right, come on, dude. But yeah, so that's kind of all that I was interested about from, like, the, you know, early Middle Ages, medieval times period. There seemed to be an explosion of Freemasonry around this early 1700s across Europe. And this is the first time, too, where we see it's founded in North America. And by this time, it somehow transitioned from a purely trade fellowship, you know, of stonemasons to a speculative fellowship, which mm-hmm. means members who weren't involved in the actual craft of masonry were invited into these lodges. And it's not particularly clear why. There's a couple of theories. It's possible that some of these lodges began to raise money by charging the gentry for admission to their, you know, mysteries, to their mysterious rites. And there's another theory that talks about how Masonic lodges would deliberately recruit rich and powerful members in an attempt to improve their pay and working conditions, which sounds familiar if you know anything about like Bohemian Grove and how that mm-hmm. started. It's a very similar to what happened, where that was kind of specifically for artists and, you know, kind of artistic souls. And slowly you get these suit types being brought in, you know, because they can fund the, you know, secretive fraternity.
And that, of course, is the only similarity between Freemasonry and Bohemian Grove.
That is
nothing else.
Yeah. So that's when it kind of transitions into what we think of it as today, where it's like a secret group of guys getting together, knocking back some whiskeys and doing something. We're not quite sure what. But one thing I thought that was interesting is, like, by the time of the early 1800s in America, there was actually some anti-Masonic movements.
Mm-hmm.
There's all sorts of people who were publishing anti-Masonic literature, whether they're people who left the Masons or just people who, I guess, didn't like the vibe.
Yeah.
but this culminated in 1826 with the Morgan Affair. Do you know anything about the Morgan Affair?
I was hoping you would mention him. Yeah, oh. This is, yeah, I did some digging on this guy. I can sum it up if you want, or if you have notes.
Yeah, go ahead.
You can go for it. Yeah, so William Morgan was a, the cool thing about William Morgan is it looks like a lot of his claims were somewhat dubious. But anyway, he was a guy just sort of hanging out in New York. He was born, hang on, let me pull it up, 1774, it says. And he gained some influence. He published a lot of literature, and he was a very prominent anti-Mason. And shortly after, he announced his intent to publish a book that would expose the secrets of Freemasonry. He was arrested on some pretty trumped up charges a couple times throughout like a week or so, and then eventually just disappeared, which, you know, pretty rough combo of events. And I think it was the case that, hang on, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia to remind myself. Yeah, it was Andrew Jackson. Yeah, because I remember that there was the anti-Mason party, which I thought was very funny. And it was founded as a result of this and just the fact that people didn't like that Andrew Jackson was a Freemason.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. And so his disappearance in, you know, combination with some of the growing tensions and also people's hate for Andrew Jackson, this caused a sort of series of protests against Freemasons all throughout the United States, but especially in New York, where Morgan was from, and kind of that Upper East area around there. And the backlash actually caused a lot of people to leave the craft of Masonry. The numbers were pretty interesting, that in 1827, the Grand Lodge of New York controlled 227 lodges. But by 1835, after this, it only had 41 left. So this was a pretty big decline. However, the Masons, not to be perturbed, did bounce back by as early as the 1850s. There was a pretty renewed popular interest around the time of the American Civil War. And if you've ever done any study on the Civil War, you'll know that this will kind of come up. Masonry will come up a lot. I thought this was interesting. This is just pulled straight from the Wikipedia, but they're talking about there's many stories of soldiers, you know, rescuing enemy combatants who are also members of the Masons. So it's like kind of interesting. And after this time period, we see what's called in America as the Golden Age of Fraternalism, which is another kind of huge explosion of these type of organizations. Obviously the Masons were a part of this, but other organizations that were involved were the Knights of Columbus, the Rechabites, the Odd Fellows, the Good Templars, the Elks, the Shriners, and the Ku Klux Klan. More on that in a minute.
One of these things is not quite like the other.
Quite like the other, yes. But you probably recognize a lot of those things. And it's funny because I had not, before doing the research for this, I had a very limited understanding of a lot of these fraternal organizations, but I recognized pretty much all of these names.
Oh yeah.
Like, where do I know the Shriners from? Where do I know the Elks from? Where do I know the Rechabites from?
These are the guys with the tiny cars.
Exactly. So a lot of this stuff is still around to some extent in America. Mm-hmm. However, around, 1920, around the time of right before the Great Depression, a lot of this stuff kind of begins to taper off, but it is still very much ingrained in American culture down to this day. But obviously in the 20th century, not quite as much, which I think is noticeable by the fact that on the Wikipedia, the 20th century Freemasonry is like a sentence long, that section.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's almost nothing on it. And, I'm not sure what more to say about that, but that's pretty much brings us, at least in America, to the modern day, in terms of the general history of Freemasonry.
Yeah, no, I think that does a good job of summing it up. I think it's always been interesting to me that, like, of all of those little, like, secret societies and things like that, like, the one that really did hold out the longest is Freemasonry. Like, that's the one that everybody still knows. Like I said, like the Shriners, honestly, pretty much the extent of most people's knowledge about them will probably be the fact that they wear silly little hats and drive little cars.
Yeah.
Unless you like know someone who's involved with it or like me are insane. And I don't know. I think that's why there's so many conspiracy theories surrounding the Freemasons.
Quote unquote.
Yeah, quote unquote conspiracy theories. And I do think it's interesting, right? Because there was definitely a time period where every single important person was a Mason, right?
Yeah.
Like, a good deal of American presidents, for instance.
We'll get there, but yes.
Yeah. And my general thoughts on the Masons now, at least, is that the sort of deep state power has shifted to another area. It doesn't seem like Masonry is the sort of prerequisite for holding political power or economic power that it was back in the day, which I think makes sense, right? Because it's the least secret or society in the world.
Yes.
And, you don't have to. I don't think that being a Mason inherently makes you someone worthy of suspicion. But I also think that all the sort of people who are drawn towards a secret society, it's the ones who go like, well, this isn't secret enough for me. Let's make a new one. Those are the guys you got to keep an eye out for.
You got to watch out for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I sort of have a similar kind of take on it to you as like, it is strange how many influential and powerful people were involved with them, especially right up to the turn of the century from the 1800s to the 1900s. And how pretty much if you just open the Wikipedia article for notable Masons, almost, I would say more than 90% of them, this is just going off the dome, but it seemed like more than 90% of them were politicians or military.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of like writers and like artists, but a lot of military intelligence and politicians, which is interesting. But, again, the scene of the world really did change after World War I and World War II. And I think power shifted, there from there as well.
Yeah. And it's, I don't even think it's necessarily a real conspiracy to say that, like, Masons will help each other out when possible, right? That's just sort
right.
of part
human
of the playbook.
Nature.
Yeah, it's human nature. If you go to the same club as someone, you're probably going to be a little more likely to help them out, say,
your boys
on the battlefield of the Civil War.
Exactly.
But
and that's sort of why I mentioned that, is like, that's kind of a smaller microcosm of probably what was happening politically. In America, we tend to think of things as very much like Republican versus Democrat, but obviously it's a lot more complicated than that. And, so if there's at least in the early 1900s, late 1800s, if there is a third, kind of brotherhood, quote unquote, so to speak, a third, allegiance that everybody was part of, and, it's not that much of a stretch to say, like, yeah, they were going to be loyal to each other, even though they may or may have been across party lines or whatever.
Exactly. Like being a Freemason doesn't make you powerful, but being a powerful Mason does make me raise my eyebrows a little bit. But again, like I said, not quite as much as for like the even more secret societies. Like, you know, like anything at Yale, like Skull and Bones or Lock and Key.
Yeah.
Like, I am very comfortable condemning all members of those groups and just being like, no, I don't trust any of them. But
yeah, I think, you know, like joining the Freemasons now is just like, it's like joining a men's club, essentially. It's not that weird. Joining Skull and Bones now is very strange because, again, it's a lot more exclusive and a lot less people know about it. I did not know about Skull and Bones until maybe 6 months ago. So, you know, it's those are two very different things, I think. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, like, you know, I think the biggest example of that, right, is, you know, you mentioned the that Pennsylvania Grand Lodge has like 100,000 members.
Yeah.
And Skull and Bones, I think, is like maybe pushing 100 total.
Yeah.
Like it's just a greater degree of exclusivity. It's much harder to not be successful if you were in Skull and Bones. And so I think secret societies in general, I'll raise my eyebrows at them, but the less secret the society, the less concerned I am.
Absolutely. And I feel the same way on it. But, you know, we kind of touched on some of the conspiracy theories out there. So might as well just jump headlong into it. We were laughing. You were laughing about the Wikipedia page for Masonic conspiracies before this started. Do you want to explain to our viewers what made you laugh?
Yeah, sure thing. So the fun thing about Wikipedia when you're doing research for something like this is it's always a great starting off point, but you do eventually hit a wall.
Yeah.
And so just for fun, I took a look at their page for the list of Masonic conspiracy theories. And some of them are, so for instance, the first one that they have, that the British judiciary is heavily infiltrated with Masons who give fellow Masons the benefit of the doubt in court. It's like, well, I don't doubt that. That feels
really
fairly reasonable.
Like a conspiracy. That just seems kind of obvious.
Yeah. And then the next one, that Freemasonry is a Jewish front for world domination. And you're, well, hang on. No. I don't believe this one. This right underneath that is that it is a front for communism.
I knew you'd love that one.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I wish. But yeah, no, it is interesting. And I'll get into this in a little bit. But fascist leaders hated the Freemasons.
Absolutely.
In large part because of their obsession, like most occult groups, with tying themselves back to like ancient Jewish traditions that won't endear you to Adolf Hitler.
No.
But then a little later on down in this list, you get things like that the Freemasons have strong links with more selective secret and semi-secret societies, such as the Bohemian Grove Meeting and the Skull and Bones Society. It's like, well, that's just true.
That is true, which we'll see. There's a little bit of evidence we'll cover later on to show that. And also that like the Ku Klux Klan is intimately tied to Freemasonry. It's like, that's just true.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that's immediately followed by like, they worship Baal, Baphomet, and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, okay, well, or like that they've infiltrated NASA to deceive the public that the Earth is flat. It's like,
I don't believe this.
Of these are not built like the others, you know?
Yeah. And I do like, also, they mentioned somewhere in here, I don't remember where it was, but it said that like many Protestant Christian groups that don't like Freemasons view it as like demonic or occult. So in other words, like, no, this is too spooky. And one of the primary reasons that the Catholic Church doesn't like Freemasonry is that it's too rationalistic. So I just like the Protestants are like, this is too spooky. And the Catholics are like, this isn't spooky enough. You can't be part of it.
That's really funny. So I think, you know, if again, to take the rational approach, like if you have a quote unquote secret society that everybody knows about, you know, it's just bound to be wrapped up in some conspiracy theories. But also, if, as we'll go over later, you know, somewhere around 17 of the sitting U.S. presidents at some point were either Freemasons or somehow involved with Masonry. And like a large number of generals and other politicians, vice presidents, etc. I don't think it's that much of a stretch to say they have an impact on politics. You know, that's just kind of is logical. So, but, you know, are they communing with the Jews to take over the world. No,
yeah, we're fairly confident in saying no.
Yeah, that's just what, that's something Hitler said. Don't be weird.
Yeah.
Are they communists? No.
Unfortunately, no.
There was a funny note too in that like communist section, which like that came from a book from the 1950s called, quote, Grand Orient Freemasonry Unmasked as the Secret Power Behind Communism, end quote, which was actually just a slightly edited republishing of an 1885 book called, quote, War of Antichrist with the Church and Christian Civilization, end quote. So those are book titles, not Fall Out Boy song titles. So it's like, that's a hefty title. But yeah, so it's just like, that's like, that level of American conspiracy has been around for some time.
Yeah.
You know, it just kind of changes its face every 50 to 60 years. But yeah, that's pretty much all I had to say about like the conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Anything else you wanted to say? I know we were going to talk about totalitarian regimes and stuff a little bit later on, but maybe we can just give people a quick look at some famous Masonic members. Or
yeah, for sure. Related.
Okay.
Look, you can't cover Freemasonry and not like list at least a couple of the famous Masons.
Yeah.
It's just part of the fun. Everybody's expecting it. You know, it's like a slasher movie. There needs at least one gratuitous murder scene.
Exactly.
And we've got to provide.
I've got about 20 something here. But but if you've got any that I missed that you want to throw in, picked ones that I thought were either A, just kind of interesting, or B, you know, interesting.
Yeah.
So the first one I had was Buzz Aldrin. Oh. Interesting. Yeah.
We won't make any more comments about that.
But Buzz Aldrin, Benedict Arnold.
That one I did know, yeah.
Yeah, Henry Ford. I bet you knew that one. John Elway, which as a Broncos fan, you know, tough. John Wayne, as we were discussing before. Benjamin Franklin, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph and Hiram Smith, which I
did
bet
know that
you
one.
Knew.
Yep. Yeah.
Ludwig von Beethoven.
Oh, that one I didn't know, actually.
Interesting, right? Thomas Hamilton. I don't know if you recognize this name. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It does.
He was a notorious child molester and murderer who was credited with killing 16 school children and a teacher, and then himself in 1996. He wasn't ever proven, but he was alleged to have involvement with the Masons.
Could I ask where we got this one? Because suddenly I think I know where I know this name from.
We'll find out in a little bit. yeah, I got it from Program to Kill. John Entwistle. Bassist for The Who.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Aleister Crowley. More on that in a minute.
Yeah.
Oscar Wilde.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is the section of the list which is all presidents. So George Washington, number one. James Monroe, fifth president. Andrew Jackson, seven. James Polk, 11. James Buchanan, 15. Andrew Johnson, 17. James Garfield, 20th. William McKinley, 25th. Theodore Roosevelt, the 26th. William Howard Taft, the 27th. Warren Harding, the 29th. Franklin D. Roosevelt, the 32nd, and also his son, Harry Truman, the 33rd. Lyndon Johnson, the 36th president of the United States, was initiated into the first degree of Masonry in 1937, but he didn't advance any further or like become a full member.
Which I kind of respect, actually.
I know, it's pretty sick.
It's not very, wanting to do any of the homework.
It's a very Lyndon Johnson move, too. Yeah. Gerald Ford, the 38th, and Ronald Reagan, the 40th, was made an honorary member. And Bill Clinton, the 42nd president of the United States, as a youth, was part of the Ordre des Mollets, which is like a branch of the Masons.
Oh.
Which, yeah, not he wasn't a Freemason per se, but he was part of like a weird branch off, which is, again, interesting. So that's, again, 17 presidents who are either documented members or associated with the Masons. So, sus.
Yeah.
The next one I have here is a General Albert Pike. And instead of me telling you who he is, I'm just going to read a long quote from Program to Kill, if you don't mind, Matt.
I will never have an objection to reading a quote from Program to Kill.
Okay, so General Albert Pike, according to Program to Kill by independent journalist Dave McGowan, was, quote, chief of intelligence for the Confederate Army and the highest-ranking Freemason in North America. In 1867, Pike incorporated Eliphas Levi's ideas into the constitution that he drafted for an overtly racist, occult-based secret society that he and an alliance of Confederate generals and intelligence operatives created following the American Civil War, the Ku Klux Klan. Levi's ideas would later find favor with the occult practitioners who engineered the rise of Nazi Germany. 1875 was also the year that a certain Edward Alexander Crowley was born. Edward, better known as Alistair, or by the grandiose label that he chose for himself, the Great B666, was without question the most influential occultist of the 20th century. He was also an ascendant of British military intelligence, just as Albert Pike was an American intelligence operative, and just as Karl Kellner, Franz Hartmann, and Theodore Roos had close ties to German intelligence entities. Mm-hmm. Hartmann, Roos, and Kellner were the primary architects of the Ordo Templar Templi Orientis, OTO, a secret society founded in Germany around 1895 that claims to be in direct line of descent from the Knights Templar, with some researchers believing it to be the granddaddy of all the occult-based secret Masonic societies.
And it is.
Yes. So that just sort of hits on all of these themes we've kind of been discussing from here. And again, yep. That's, you know, direct ties between Masonry and the Ku Klux Klan, and also other secret societies like OTO, and of course anything that Crowley was involved with. And there was a name in there mentioned, Eliphas Levi, a name which I had heard but wasn't sure about. But that was another ceremonial magician, kind of like Crowley. Former Catholic. I forget what his rank was, but he was involved in the Catholic Church, left, joined the Grand Orient de France, which is the French Masonic organization that originated continental Freemasonry, and then split away from that and then started doing his own like occult stuff later.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I will say, as far as the Klan and Masonry goes, that one I think is a really good just sort of object lesson for why it's so difficult to make a broad definitive statement about Masonry.
Yeah.
Because the Klan, as noted, definitely incorporated Masonic elements, and a lot of its founders were big fans, but also later on it notably terrorized Masons and didn't like them. And I think that's part of the interesting things, that there were like Masonic lodges that were just fronts for the Klan. There were Masonic lodges that were designed explicitly around preventing harassment from the Klan. Like, it's such a broad organization.
Yeah.
And it's simultaneously so centralized and also so decentralized that it's really hard to say anything definitively about it as a whole.
Right.
Which is what makes it so interesting, but also so difficult to cover in just one thing.
Well, it's very amorphous, and you know, it's kind of like American politics. It's just very complicated, and you know, it's very big and unwieldy. So there's a lot of these different, like you said, factions kind of pushing against each other. So you can't, like any huge body, you can't definitively say one thing. You can really only kind of generalize. But yeah, that is very interesting. That kind of ends off my roster of interesting people. Was there anyone you wanted to throw in that you felt I missed?
Just a couple people who I will touch on as relates to my specific little lesson. I think in terms of like American Masons, you played all the hits, right? All the presidents.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know. Like you said, a lot of generals, not many of whom have names that like mean a lot unless you like really look into them. So I think those are the big ones.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that sort of brings us to my notes. I know you said you could speak at length on what you had prepared for us.
Oh, and I will.
Why don't we transition into that? I'm ready to be wowed.
So, all right, we're just going to jump into this then. And listeners, stay tuned. We're going to spend a second talking about something that will have no clear links to Freemasonry. But don't worry, I'll tie into it.
Okay.
Let's talk Gladio. So Operation Gladio was, and many listeners will be familiar with this, it was a clandestine stay-behind operation run by NATO in conjunction with, who else, the CIA, in Europe throughout the Cold War. So Gladio is often used to refer to like all of their tinkering throughout Europe, but it was the name of the operation specifically focused on Italy. It ran from about 1956, although sources differ on when it started, to 1990, where curiously all sources agree it stopped operations and never did anything again. So originally and officially, It was set up to help prepare for a Soviet invasion of Europe, you know, in case any of those Warsaw Pact countries just decided, let's go hot and just storm the beaches. In reality, of course, it consisted of murdering communist activists, funneling money into fascist terrorism, and generally pursuing what is now called a strategy of tension, right? Just sort of causing terrorism and overall chaos to prevent organization and just sort of cause a general sense of fear and disruption among people throughout the country.
That doesn't sound familiar to anything I've ever heard ever.
It's very funny. Yeah, my next note was, I would like to note, of course, that there is absolutely no reason to think that this incredibly successful strategy of disruption would be tried anywhere else in the world, especially not today. Yeah. When has the CIA been known to do things on U.S. citizens? That's what I thought.
Yeah.
So later investigations found records of explicit orders to infiltrate leftist groups and then try to incite violence, which, of course, says, is to say nothing of the money and weapons that were just straight up funneled into right-wing groups.
Right.
Let's see. So the worst of these, the biggest, like, Gladio thing directly linked to Gladio, or allegedly directly linked to Gladio, was the 1980 Bologna Massacre. I don't know if you're familiar with this one, but a bomb hidden in a train station was detonated. It killed 85 people outright and wounded more than 200 more. Because the bomb, the explosion itself didn't kill all of those people, but it did collapse part of the train station and cause a train to derail. And now, I know what you're all thinking, listeners. Yikes, this is really bad. What does any of that have to do with Freemasonry? Well, now it's time to jump into Propaganda 2, also known as P2. This was a Masonic lodge. It was founded in 1877 in northern Italy and quickly became popular among the politicians and businessmen who were unable to visit their own lodges while they were traveling in northern Italy. This is the big moral of this episode, is never trust a northern Italian. like the OTO, P2 was outlawed by Mussolini's fascist government in 1925. Which outlawed Freemasonry and other secret societies. But following World War II, Masonry, while it was still technically illegal, nobody cared anymore. And so it became functionally legal throughout Italy again, and P2 began chugging along again, although it was a lot smaller, had a lot less activity. There were far fewer meetings occurring than there had been before. Enter one Licio Gelli. So this guy was a fascist through and through. To the extent that he volunteered to join the black shirts that were sent over to help Franco's fascist government during the Spanish Civil War, before later going on to serve as an official liaison between Nazi Germany and the Italian government in World War II. Mm-hmm. And since that isn't enough to add to your fascist resume prior to becoming a Freemason, he then served in the Republic of Salo, which was the German puppet state that ran Italy in the later half of World War II. All around, great guy, as you may be able to tell from this.
Salo, which you may recommend from the worst movie you'll ever watch in your life.
Yeah, exactly. That's the very same. Interestingly enough, I mentioned Franco there. Franco, of course, was a devoted anti-Freemason, believing that Masons were working in tandem with the communists, and he would frequently rail against both during speeches and writing. Which I just thought was interesting because so we're going to jump forward a little bit. In 1964, Gelli becomes a Mason. And in 1966, the Freemasons of Italy are starting to get a little worried because leftist ideas in post-fascist states became very popular. Something about being run by the fascists and then freed by the Soviets really does do something to the people's minds. I guess it was mostly Americans who helped out in Italy. But regardless, leftism was very popular because people were like, let's try the exact opposite of what we were just doing. And a lot of these Masons were powerful politicians and businessmen. And so that was not great for them. And they began to get very worried. So, like I said, this is 1966. 2 years after becoming a Mason, Gelli is tasked with reorganizing the structure of P2 specifically. And he takes a list of all of the members of the lodge, many of whom were inactive because the lodge was being watched pretty closely by the Christian Democrat Party, who didn't trust the Masons. and he starts to form this wide-reaching network of powerful friends and allies. And throughout the 1970s, P2 functionally served as a shadow government throughout Italy. Now, I would like to note, in 1976, Gelli and P2 were officially expelled from the Masonic Order by the Italian Grand Lodge, meaning that Freemasons, I mean, as far as the Italian Freemasons were concerned, much of this was being done illegally.
Right.
But regardless, this is a Masonic lodge, and I think it's the most obvious example of Masons quite literally running a country, which is why I wanted to talk about it.
No, and I think that's a good thing to cover, because while it matches with our theme of, you know, like, it's not some big overarching conspiracy, you know, that right now, at least, that they're puppeting the government and blah, 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 blah. But it could happen, because if you get a bunch of powerful people and stick them together, I mean, like,
they'll probably do some bad things.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're seeing, you know, with the technocrats of the current day. Like, it's just a thing that happens. And so I don't think it's too unreasonable to be like, Masons were very powerful, especially, you know, in the early 1900s and before, right? Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to say on P2?
Oh, quite a bit more. If you'll humor me.
I will humor you. The funny thing is, I'm out of notes and we still got 20 minutes left. So please, I'll humor you.
Yeah. Sweet. So I have a list of some of the most powerful members of P2.
Okay.
So there were the heads of every single Italian intelligence agency, of which there were quite a few, almost 200 military officers, dozens of different bankers, including the heads of the three largest banks in the country, and 44 members of the Italian parliament, most notably future Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. In addition, P2 had great influence in Argentina, with some of its members, including the likes of Guillermo Suarez Mason, a fascist mass murderer, kidnapper, and later head of the Latin American chapter of the World Anti-Communist League. Which, of course, so he had a bunch of close ties to some of the big movers and shakers in the Operation Condor scene down in Latin America.
Oh, interesting.
And also through the World Anti-Communist League, also to 2008 presidential nominee John McCain, who was a member of the World Anti-Communist League. Interesting note I discovered.
So these are the type of people who are anti-communist.
Yeah, these are the guys he's rubbing elbows with. And so from that alone, it should be obvious what the Gladio connections are, but we are just getting started. So Gelli was at one point introduced to Nixon's military advisor, Alexander Haig, by CIA officer Ted Shackley, who headed Operation Mongoose, which was the CIA's attempts to kill Castro, as well as the Phoenix program in Vietnam.
Oh, so,
very cool. Gelli was explicitly instructed by Henry Kissinger to recruit several hundred of the members P2 had, and was president at the inaugurations of Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, and received front row seats for the inauguration of the great beast 666 himself, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I saw that. That's, again, man, so many returning villains. Henry Kissinger being a big name, but
yeah, his villainous head rearing once more. So after the Cold War, Gelli said of P2 and Gladio's forces, quote, many came from the ranks of mercenaries who had fought in the Spanish Civil War, and many came from the fascist Republic of Salo. They chose individuals who were proven anti-communists. I know it was a well-constructed organization. Had communist strength grown in Italy, America would have assisted us. We would have unleashed another war, and we would have been generously supplied with arms from the air. Worrying. So how do we know all this? Well, it was really only exposed as a result of the collapse of a bank called the Banco Ambrosiano. This was an Italian bank. The main shareholder was the Vatican Bank. It was headed by P2 member Roberto Calvi, who is mentioned, interestingly enough, on the Masonic conspiracy theories page.
Yes, he was.
He was killed by people in P2. Just side note, but we'll get into him soon.
Wow.
So Calvi's heavy involvement with the Catholic Church's finances earned him the nickname God's Banker, which admittedly is a really sick nickname.
It's
pretty cool.
I'll give him that. Yeah, I'll budge on that one. That's cool.
He also allegedly was involved in the murder of Pope John Paul I, who was planning to reform the Vatican Bank structure, although there is almost nothing to substantiate that. But it popped up and I did feel the need to point that out, that there's people out there saying he was involved in it.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Pope John Paul just died of a heart attack. I haven't found much compelling evidence that he was murdered.
I had looked into that too actually a while ago, and it did feel like he just died of a heart attack. Or maybe he was struck down by God himself. I couldn't really say.
Jury's out still. Calvi used a vast network of overseas banks to funnel money out of Italy. So some of it went to I skipped a note. My apologies. In conjunction with a few members of the Vatican Bank, Calvi funneled money into, among other things, the Polish anti-communist trade union Solidarity, and the Nicaraguan Contras, because, of course, Iran-Contra is going to come up in this story.
Yes.
So Calvi used a vast network of overseas banks to funnel money out of Italy. Some went to the aforementioned causes, some went to the mafia, some went to P2 and Lucio Gelli, and a lot went to Roberto Calvi. Remember that train bombing I mentioned before? Would you be surprised to learn that several of the investigators who were responsible for fabricating the claims that KGB agents and communists were involved in this bombing were members of P2?
No.
Or, more interestingly still, that both Roberto Calvi and P2 had close ties to the Magliana gang, who provided the money and weapons used by the NAR, the right-wing terrorists that actually did perpetrate this bombing.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, the NAR and the Magliana family were also responsible for murdering several journalists and had ties to the attempted assassins of Pope John Paul II. So it was just a rough time to be Pope, I guess. But so eventually law enforcement caught wind of this and began looking into things because the Bank of Italy, which is like the national bank, produced a report on Ambrosiano that functionally boiled down to going like, yo, these guys are definitely stealing. Like, there's no way that this is above water. And so in 1981, the police raided the offices of Lucio Gelli looking for evidence against Calvi. And they found a list of P2's members, which sowed the seed for Gelli's downfall. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, there were about 1,600 names on that list of people.
Wow.
Yeah, and they weren't all P2 members. Some of them were just people in his actual Rolodex.
Right.
But regardless, it's a really big list of names.
It is.
And only like 900 of those names were actually released, which is weird. You know, very like Epstein's Black Book kind of vibes, where it's like, all right, can we see the list of names?
Yeah. No. What do you got to lose by showing us?
Yeah,
apparently. Apparently, yeah.
But yeah, and so in 1982, it was found that this bank couldn't account for what is about $3 billion in today's money.
Good Lord.
Which is a quite notable hole to have in your bank accounts. So Calvi fled the country, understandably, because things are starting to heat up for him. And he was later found hanging from the scaffolding of London's Blackfriars Bridge, with five bricks in his pockets and several thousand dollars as well. This was ruled a suicide, of course.
Right.
Interesting note, P2 and its members called themselves the Black Friars. So very weird that Blackfriars Bridge is where he's found hanging.
Oh, that is an interesting coincidence.
Yeah, it was funny because the first article I found that mentioned that it was Blackfriars Bridge is like, this was very interesting. And I was like, wait. Why? Because they didn't mention that that's what P2 and its members called themselves. But I found that. So that was just a creepy, spooky little coincidence.
Yeah.
Or a very thinly veiled threat to other people on this sinking ship. Also, the day before his death, he was officially stripped of his position at the bank. And his personal secretary left a note denouncing his actions and then, according to the official narrative, jumped out the window to her death. And initially I was like, well, this is pretty suspicious, right? That she's going to write this note going, this is all his fault. That is why I am choosing to kill myself of my own accord. But then I thought a little more, I can absolutely picture like Livia Soprano doing this. So maybe she did just do that herself. I'm still not sure on that one.
It's one of those things where it could be suspicious, like in with all the other things that we've talked about surrounding his death, it comes off as a little suspicious, but like it also does make sense. So
yeah, exactly.
Inconclusive, so, I would say.
I'm not sure about her, but yeah. So later autopsies showed that the wounds on Calvi's neck were inconsistent with a death by hanging. And also that he had not touched the bricks in his pockets, which feels slightly more notable to point out. Going like, also the wounds were inconsistent and he's not the one who put those bricks in his pockets, but
yeah, you know, that's really weird. Cause then how did they get there? Right.
Yeah, exactly. It's very strange.
Did he put gloves on to put bricks in his pocket? Like what?
They can't know who did this.
Yeah. They'll never know. You're hanging in your own apartment. They'll never figure it out.
Yeah. So, anyway, also in 1982, P2 was officially disbanded by the Italian government. And police later found a document titled Plan for a Democratic Rebirth hidden in the possession of Licio Gelli's daughter. And this one stated, among other things, this was an old plan. It stated, among other things, that a proposed 1978 alliance between the Christian Democrats and the Italian Communist Party was very dangerous to their goals and had to be disrupted. Interestingly, this alliance was in fact disrupted, as former Prime Minister Aldo Moro, one of the primary forces calling for this alliance, was kidnapped and murdered by a left-wing terrorist group known as the Red Brigades. And now, I'm not going to say that P2, in conjunction with Gladio forces, infiltrated the Red Brigades and murdered this guy. But I am going to say that P2 said they didn't want this to happen, and that Gladio has, in the past, explicitly ordered people to infiltrate leftist groups and do acts of violence. So, you know, as far as circumstantial evidence goes, it's not looking great for our boy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Gelli later escaped charges relating to Roberto Calvi's murder and to the Bologna massacre, because there wasn't enough, like, solid evidence connecting him to either of those things. Just, you know, millions of dollars trading hands, which I guess wasn't enough. But he did serve some prison time for, you know, operating the deep state and just general corruption.
Right.
And he got, like, all of those sentences reduced. When he was extradited from Switzerland, apparently there were 100 sharpshooters along the train path that he was on, which feels very Mission Impossible. Like, they have, like, fake train cars and all sorts
of
security.
That's going to be a sick set piece. I just know.
I know. Yeah, I can just see Tom Cruise breaking him out so they can, like, find the location of the nuclear bombs or whatever.
So cool. Yeah.
It is crazy how fun those movies are.
I should hate
them, but
it's like Top Gun. It's like, you should hate them, but just the power of Tom Cruise prevents you.
Yeah. So anyway, one other thing, I found no evidence for this outside of Lucio Gelli's Wikipedia page. Like, I really looked, but I couldn't find anything. But he was apparently nominated for a Nobel Prize in Literature and was supported in this by Mother Teresa. And I just, like I said, I didn't spend a ton of time looking, but I couldn't find any sources that mentioned this. Most of them were, like, in Italian, so I'm not sure how good they were.
Yeah.
But
what does that mean?
A really weird note. I don't know what it means, but
yeah, that's strange.
I've just been mulling on that one for a few days now and needed to share that with other people. Anyway, my final note that I would like to make about P2 is that they took control of a bunch of newspapers, right? That was also part of their project for plan for a democratic rebirth, the project for a new Italian century, if you would. But in one of the newspapers that they took over, they published a super long interview with Gelli in 1980, in which he explicitly stated that he wanted to rewrite the Italian constitution to be more fascistic, and was asked by the interviewer, who was also a member of P2, what he had always wanted to be, and his response was a puppet master. Which, wild that he felt comfortable just admitting that in the newspaper that he had just, like, bought out forcibly to spread his message. But
wow.
So yeah, that's P2. Like I said,
they love saying the quiet parts loud, huh?
They love saying the quiet parts out loud. So in part, I've been reading a lot about Gladio lately, and I just wanted to yell at you guys about it. And also, because, you know, like we've said before, right? This, it wasn't even entirely a Masonic lodge. But I think the real problem with any of these sorts of secret societies is that when you get a group of people who love keeping secrets together, and one of them happens to be a super powerful bad actor, shockingly, some bad things might occur. And, you know, you're going to end up funneling millions of dollars into Argentina. Oh, they also, I forgot to mention this, but they were accused of funneling money into Peru, which was then given to the Argentinians during the Falklands War, which is very funny. So I do have to give them credit for that. Anybody who's willing to fund anti-British military action can't be all bad, but...
I guess you're right.
I mean, in all seriousness, it's a very crazy story. And just like Freemasonry as a whole, there's a lot of debate about the true extent of P2's power.
Right. But
personally, as you may be able to guess, I definitely lean on the side that they were all very, very connected with Gladio and responsible for a lot of terrible things that occurred during the years of lead in Italy. But fortunately, a strategy like that would never be pursued here, so we can all rest easy.
We can all rest easy. And I think that's a nice happy ending to our episode on Freemasons, is that bad things have happened, but they would never happen again, would they? Yeah.
And they aren't happening now. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
I was just saying, you know, Yale, I'm open. Send me a scholarship. I will join Skull and Bones and walk back everything I've ever said on this podcast.
Absolutely. I'm just so easily viable. Just for a chance to
be in a room with George W. Bush.
Yeah, right. Hey, actually, you know what's interesting is I just now realized I did leave one name off of my list of Freemasons.
Oh, do tell.
And that was, and I just found this out a couple of days ago while talking to my mother, but my grandfather on her side was a Mason. Now, we're not rich, so he was not a high. He wasn't, must not have been a high ranking member. But another thing that I didn't know about him is I knew he was in World War II, but I did not know he was an intelligence officer.
Oh no!
So I'm compromised, I guess. Yeah. But don't worry. I shouldn't say don't worry, but he did die when she was 10. So knew the guy. Yeah, good. No, not good. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying. So very, that was a fun, interesting bit of family lore that came out while I was
compromised Roswell.
I know, right? I was like, God dang it. It is one of those things where, like, had I not recently started my anxiety medication, that would have ruined me. Because even like recent, when I found out about that, I was like, is it all a lie? Is it all constructed to get me? But I don't know. I don't think he was that high ranking. So we're safe. We're good.
All right, we're good.
We're safe. Yeah.
And listeners, you've already listened to an hour at this point, so it's too late. You're in too deep. You're part of it. You're you're complicit now, so you might as well keep listening.
And if you don't like me, well, maybe your laundry might catch on fire sometimes. Is there anything else you want to say before we close down?
No, I think that's about it, right? You know, don't join secret societies, folks.
Nope.
That's my closing message for you all.
Cool. Anything else you want to say to close it out?
Oh, right. Yes. If you would like to join our secret society, you can follow us on Twitter at HistEsoteric, on Instagram at HistoricEsoterica. And you could just give us a follow on whatever you're listening to us on right now. 5 stars. Always appreciated. We love it.
Yeah.
Get in touch with us. Suggest topics. And finally, as my John Oliver call to action to all of you, I would implore you all to remember, it's all connected.
So what is Freemasonry? Is it a satanic enterprise or a form of devil worship? Why is it a men-only affair? And why are they so secretive?
You were both in Skull and Bones, the secret society. It's so secret we can't talk about it.
What does that mean for America? The conspiracy theorists are going to go
wild. Sure they are. I don't know. I haven't seen the website.
Number 322?
America lost a really fine citizen yesterday when Tim Russert passed away.
Well, Freemasonry is a society like many other societies. It is arguably one of the oldest societies in the world, coming from medieval times. But our main objective is charity, if you ask me. The first thing is what the citation from King Solomon to God that I shall build you an house and you shall establish your throne forever.